If I'm correct, this will wrap up the unit, right? It's the last plant chapter, which means that just a few seconds from a week from now is the next test. Let me just remind you, in case you're wondering, test four is the final. There's no comprehensive final in here. Test four is just the unit four test. We do it during finals week, but it's not longer or anything. Okay, the final plant chapter that we're looking at here is one that's about responses of plants to various signals, internal and external signals. In other words, it's how plants know how to react to different situations. And in the opening slide, something that I'm sure you're all familiar with if you've ever looked at potted plants. Seedlings will start to grow in one direction, especially indoors. You see this if you have a potted plant in a window, they'll grow in one direction. And that's, of course, not a coincidence. They're all growing in the same direction because they're all growing toward where the light is, right? Whereas if they were outside, they would be growing pretty much straight upward. So it's no great secret. We've known for thousands of years that plants respond to light, which of course makes perfect sense for any phototroph, right? For any photosynthetic organism. Of course, it's important to be able to respond to light because light is what feeds you, or light is what provides the energy for you to be able to feed yourself. That's no news, but for most of human history, we didn't know how that happened. So a fundamental question is, how does this reaction to light occur? Well, in slide two, we can see some results of experimentation by Darwin and Darwin. Now that's the Darwin and his son. They were trying to play around with this question themselves with corn seedlings. So this is a brand new coleoptile that's growing out of the soil. But really, the species doesn't matter. It's just they use corn because it's easy to manipulate and easy to grow. The control in the upper left is simply the unmanipulated situation. So it's what you just saw a photograph of in the previous slide. If you have light coming from one direction rather than from all directions, which is what they were using, then you'll see a bending of the coleoptile or the seedling toward that light. You already know that. What Darwin and Darwin did then to play around with that is to first remove the tips of their subjects. So they just cut off the tips. And when they did that, even with light only coming from one direction, they noticed that they would just grow straight upward. They wouldn't bend toward the light. So just that result alone hints at there being something involved in the tip of the seedling for it to be able to sense this light or respond to this light. But, of course, cutting off the tip is an injury, right? So it might just be that they injured the plant and that's why it lost its ability. It might not necessarily have anything to do with the tip. Because when you think about it, it's not the tip that is bending, right? In the control, the unmanipulated one, it's farther downward, the main length of the stalk that's bending, not the tip. So in the next manipulation, to test for whether it was actually just because it was injured that this happened, instead of cutting it, they didn't injure it at all, they just covered it with an opaque cap. Opaque meaning that blocks all the light. So the tip itself is in the dark, the rest of it is in the light. And when they did that, it was the same as if they had actually cut the tip off. So this is stronger evidence that the tip is somehow involved, right? On the other hand, you could say, well, it might simply be that the tip is being touched that's somehow interfering with this ability. So to make up for that, they made basically an identical cap, only it wasn't opaque. And it touched the tip as much as the opaque one did, but it let the light through. And when they did that, then it showed, then it went back into the normal behavior of bending toward the light. So that's even stronger evidence that the tip is involved somehow, right? That the tip is in some way, and this doesn't say how, but in some way it is sensing whether light is there. It's receiving the light. In this final manipulation, they used an opaque sleeve around the part that actually bends, but left the tip exposed. And it would still bend even though the light wasn't hitting the part that was bending. So this is an important manipulation because it shows that where the bending is happening, which is where the reaction is occurring, the reaction to that stimulus, is not where the stimulus is being received, right? The stimulus, according to these results, is being received. The light is the stimulus in this case. It's being received at the tip, but the response to that stimulus is being exercised at a place that doesn't even have to be lit up at all. And so these results suggest that somehow the plant is receiving the light and then sending a signal to a different part of the plant that then responds to that signal. All right? Well, Boyce and Jensen took the ball and ran with it from the Darwins. What's happening here is that just like the Darwins, the tip was severed. But unlike the Darwins, that tip was put back into place only with a slab of gelatin between the two pieces of the plant. Now, gelatin was used because it's a semi-solid. It's solid enough to work with as a solid, but it's not a true solid, and therefore things can diffuse through it. So the reason that was chosen is that what seems to be going on here, according to the Darwin's results, is that in response to light at the tip, cells at the tip seem to be creating a chemical signal that then is sent to the rest of the plant for its response. And by using a gel cube, that if a chemical signal actually is being created by the tip, it would be able to diffuse through, to permeate through that gel and go to the rest of the plant. And notice that it did act just like it was never severed. On the other hand, if you put a mica slab there, mica is a rock, so it is impermeable to any chemical signal that might be created, then it acted like you completely removed the tip and never replaced it. So this is getting closer to the truth. This is demonstrating pretty well that there must be a chemical signal affecting this behavior in response to light. It doesn't at all say what the chemical signal is, though. Well, an even greater refinement of this is shown in slide 3, using an agar cube instead of gelatin. That doesn't really matter. Either one of them does the same thing. Agar is just made out of different stuff. Gelatin is from animal bones, and agar is from seaweed, but they both make a kind of a semi-solid. But what's different here is that the tip of the plant was removed, and then just the tip was put onto the agar and left there for a while. Then the tip was removed from the agar, and just the agar was put onto the rest of the plant. And it still would respond by bending. So this is the strongest evidence, right? Because what's happening here apparently is that there is a chemical signal when whatever it is goes into the cube, then the tip isn't necessary at all. It's just the chemical that came from the tip but that's now in the cube that gets transferred to the rest of the plant for it to bend. And in fact, by positioning the cube either to one side or the other, you could make the plant bend even away from light because it is responding to the chemical, not to the light. The light caused the chemical to be created, but then it was the chemical that actually causes the bending. And so what we have here is the first experimental evidence of the existence of a plant hormone. This is the first discovered plant hormone, or evidence for it. They actually didn't isolate the hormone, but this is the first evidence that hormones exist in plants. And hormones, just like they are in animals, are examples of chemical signals. A chemical signal is simply some sort of molecule or some particle, some substance, that causes something to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't there. And in general, chemical signals operate by binding. They operate as ligands. Ligand is a general word, right? Probably talked about ligands a lot in 181. To ligate means to tie or to bind. Same as in like a ligature, a surgical ligature, which you tie. So a ligand is a real general word that simply means anything that binds to something. For instance, a substrate is an example of a ligand because it binds to an enzyme. Well, chemical signals are examples of ligands because no chemical signal will have any effect in the cell unless it binds to a thing we call a receptor. That's how chemical signals operate, including your own hormones. Those aren't the only chemical signals. You have neurotransmitters and neurohormones and neuromodulators. Drugs are also examples of chemical signals. All of them only have effects because they can bind to certain receptors. And what kind of molecules are the receptors? The ligands can be just about anything, molecularly speaking. But in all cases, the receptors are what kind of molecules? Which of the four kinds of macromolecules would be the best candidates for being receptors? Proteins. Why proteins? Was it just a pure guess? But why? What is it? What's special about proteins compared to the other three macromolecule classes that make them excellent candidates for being receptors? What has to be true of a receptor for it to be a good receptor? Well, in order for it to work as a receptor, it has to be able to accept a ligand, right? It has to be able to bind that ligand temporarily, at least. And therefore, it has to have a correct shape. It's kind of like a lock and key mechanism, just like a substrate and an enzyme, only for a different purpose. And proteins are the best candidates for having particular shapes, because proteins can have just about any shape you can imagine, since there's so many ways of putting the 20 amino acids together in different combinations. Okay, so receptors are always proteins. Some signals are proteins themselves. So a protein binding as a ligand to another protein called the receptor, but in other cases, the signals are really some other molecule. And we use all kinds of chemical signals as animals. Plants use chemical signals as well, though, and plants' chemical signals are categorized for as hormones, just like some of our chemical signals are, for the same reason. Hormones are signals that are broadcast throughout the body. You know, that's a fundamental difference between a hormone in your body and a neurotransmitter in your body. They can be even the same chemical. But if it's operating as a neurotransmitter, that means it's being released by a neuron and it doesn't reach the whole body. It only reaches that nearby cell, which could be another neuron, for instance. A hormone, on the other hand, gets secreted into the bloodstream. and therefore makes it everywhere that there are living cells, because they all get blood. Right? That's what makes it a hormone, that it's broadcast. It's not targeted to a specific cell. Importantly, though, it can affect just a specific kind of cell. For instance, oxytocin, good example of a hormone that affects mostly only the uterus. It's what causes uterine contractions during parturition or labor. The rest of the body is receiving that oxytocin during labor, but it's just not responding. Why is the rest of the body not responding to the oxytocin? Doesn't even know it's there. Why? Those cells don't have the right kind of proteins operating as receptors. Exactly. That's what I was saying before when I said no signal does anything, no chemical signal does anything unless it can bind to a specific receptor. Okay, so let's go to slide 4 and look at this table of plant hormones. Now, this is not at all an exhaustive list. We're continuing all the time to discover new plant hormones that do different things. But these are some major categories of hormones that have been pretty well studied. We'll just go in order. Auxin, which notice is abbreviated as IAA. You don't have to remember this, but IAA stands for indole acetic acid. That's just a chemical name. But auxins is a category. And in fact, that hormone responsible for the bending of the corn seedlings that the Darwins were studying is auxin. That was the first isolated plant hormone once they actually figured out chemically what it was. Now, we have here six different categories. The first four of them are, in one way or another, growth hormones, meaning that they promote some sort of growth. The fifth one here is kind of the opposite of that. But let's just go through these major things that happen. Auxins, notice, in the major functions column, stimulate stem elongation, that is primary growth, right? So that's a type of growth. But notice it says low concentration only. This is a tricky thing about chemical signals. You can have exactly the same chemical do different things, and in fact, opposite things at different concentrations. So it's not important only that the correct chemical signal is present. It also has to be present in a certain concentration for it to have a certain effect. And also, sometimes it's not just the presence of a single chemical. Sometimes you have to have a certain ratio of two different chemical signals present to have the actual effect. But anyway, low concentration, stem elongation, formation of lateral and adventitious roots, that's still growth. So this is definitely a growth hormone. Apical dominance, I remember I mentioned this before. What is apical dominance? What does apical refer to? Right, an apical bud, for instance. And what is housed in an apical bud? What's the bud contain that makes it a bud? Site of new growth, right? Which is called what in a plant? The juvenile structures that plants have throughout their lifetime are called what? No idea? Well, what do you have at apical buds? What does an apical bud contain that makes it juvenile? that's responsible for primary growth. A meristem. So apical meristems are the meristems that are at the very tips of a shoot. Not necessarily the very top of the plant, but at the end somewhere, at a tip. And then there are other meristems that are at nodes, right? Those are axillary meristems. And remember I said that apical dominance means that the apical bud dominates over the axillary buds and keeps those axillary buds from developing further unless something happens to the apical bud. Well, the reason that dominance exists is because auxin is released by the apical bud, travels to the axillary buds where their meristems are, and holds them in check, saying it's not your turn to grow right now. But if something comes along, an animal comes along and bites that tip off, it's no longer producing auxin. So the dominance is broken, and therefore the axillary buds take over growing, which is exactly why nipping houseplants in the bud works for making them more bushy, right? You're breaking that dominance and forming it to get more bushy, branching more rather than growing longer at each stem. All right, let's go to the second one, which is called cytokinins. Now, what does that name look very similar to? Cytokinesis, which is part of cell division, right? Cell division is a combination of mitosis and cytokinesis. And that's exactly why these things were named this, because they regulate cell division primarily. That's not their only function, but you can see that's a major function. So they're well named, but cell division is what gives rise to new cells, right? And that's how plants or any multicellular organism grows. You grow by creating new cells, all of which remain small. You don't just have one cell be very big. You add additional cells. So this is also a growth hormone, obviously. Gibberellins, which are next. Seems like a weird name, but that was just named for the things that they were discovered in. There are certain gibberellins aren't the group of organisms that they're named after are not the only things that produce gibberellins, but that's why they got their name. Plants in general create these gibberellins as growth hormones, stimulate stem elongation, but a different kind of growth here related to reproductive cycle is pollen development and pollen tube growth. So remember I was talking about the cells on either side of the egg, synergids, that guide the growth of the boring of the tube down toward the ovule. Well, one of the main things that does that is gibberellins. Okay, brassinosteroids are next. And this is also named after the things they were discovered in. But notice that brassinosteroids are steroids, as you see in the name. It's just one type of steroids that plants use. Now, if you think about our own steroids, we have several different kinds of steroids that we produce, right? Like cortisol, aldosterone, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. Those are all steroids. Those have drastically different effects, by the way, right? Obviously. But they all start out as the same chemical. And it's only that precursor chemical is only changed just a little bit to make one or the other. So all those steroids are really similar to each other despite their drastically different effects. It shows you the importance of functional groups in chemicals. They really change the functions of the overall molecule by having different functional groups. But does anyone know what that precursor chemical is for animals, for all the steroid hormones? What do we make all of our steroid hormones out of? Cholesterol. Which is just one reason why we can't live without cholesterol. We wouldn't have any steroid hormones without it. Cholesterol is also an important component of our cell membranes. But cholesterol is an animal steroid. So all animals produce it. It can cause problems, obviously. That's why it has bad press nowadays, cholesterol. You're not going to take in any cholesterol unless you eat animals. But even a vegan can have cholesterol problems. Why? How is that? Like, for instance, I am vegan. I never eat any cholesterol. But my cholesterol can still be high. How can that be? Why? Because I make my own. I'm an animal, right? Just like any other animal, I can't live without cholesterol. So the reason my body has cholesterol is because I make my own. That's why other animals that humans eat have their own. And so they make their own cholesterol and take additional cholesterol in if they eat them. Plants have steroids, but they don't have cholesterol as their precursor molecule. Their class of steroids, in general, are called phytosterols. Phyto meaning plant. And so brassinosteroids are an example of a phytosterol. Well, anyway, notice that this promotes cell expansion and cell division. So once again, growth. Promotes root growth at low concentrations. Inhibits root growth at high concentrations. So that's a good example of what I was saying earlier. Exactly the same chemical can have even opposite effects in the same organism if the concentration is different. Okay, those are all, in one way or another, growth hormones, like I said. Then we get to abscisic acid, ABA for short, in parentheses there. This is kind of an unfortunate misnomer. It's misnamed. Abscisic acid got its name for the process known as abscission. Abscission is it was what happens when a leaf on a deciduous tree falls off of the tree. That is abscission. Same root as in scissors. It's a cutting that happens between the petiole of the leaf that's hanging on to the stem and the stem itself. So the reason that abscisic acid got its name is that the researcher mistakenly thought that abscisic acid was the hormone in charge of abscission, leaf abscission. Turned out not to be true, but we kept the name anyway. That's why it's confusing nowadays. It really should have been renamed. It's important for other reasons, though, just not for leaf abscission. Notice, though, that it inhibits growth. So unlike these other four above it, it's not a growth hormone, a growth-promoting hormone. It's a growth-inhibiting hormone. It's also, though, important for stomatal closure during drought stress. So this is a chemical that affects whether the pumps get turned on or off. Those pumps responsible for pumping potassium ions. Remember when we talked about the closure, the opening and closing of a stoma by the guard cells? Well, they are responding to some signal. Abscisic acid is an important signal in that. But also, it promotes seed dormancy. That means it keeps seeds dormant, keeps them from developing. Seeds are alive, or the embryo that's inside that seed is alive, but sometimes just barely. It's dormant because it's almost no metabolism. It's just barely alive. And depending on the species, that can be for a long time until the correct environmental cue tells the seed now it's time to sprout. Well, abscisic acid is what's keeping it continuously from sprouting or from germinating.
Okay.
And it also promotes leaf senescence.
Abscisic acid does. What is senescence? It's the process, it's the corresponding adjective is senile. Senescence means aging. So instead of making new growth, abscisic acid actually promotes these leaves into aging and dying before they fall. And that's why they mistakenly thought it was responsible for abscission. But the leaf senescence happens first, and that's a different process compared to the abscission that happens later. Okay, then we get to ethylene on the bottom, which chemically speaking is the simplest of these because ethylene is just a simple hydrocarbon that you might be familiar with. It's just two carbons and six hydrogens, right? It's the second simplest hydrocarbon after methane. Ethylene, not ethane. Ethylene is a little bit more complicated, but it's still just a two-carbon compound. It's ethylene and not an alkane because it has a double bond between the carbons. But ethylene is in other situations, just a simple gas. In plants, though, that simple gas is used as a chemical. Kind of like nitric oxide is a simple gas, and it's used as a chemical signal in us. Right? That's what Viagra is all about. Well, ethylene does several different things, as you see here, including, though, importantly, promoting ripeness in fruits. And so this is exactly what's behind... I haven't seen the commercials in a while, but there used to be commercials that would pop up about green bags. Have you ever seen these green bags that are just plastic bags? They're green that you're supposed to buy off TV and put fruit in them to keep them from spoiling. They will spoil eventually, obviously, but they're supposed to keep for much longer. Unlike a lot of things as seen on TV, they actually work, though, because the stuff that the bag is made out of is a chemical that will react with ethylene. And if ethylene reacts with another chemical, that means you no longer have the ethylene there, right? It's turned into a product, which is something else. So you put these fruit in the bag, the ethylene is building up in the air because the fruit, as it ripens, is releasing ethylene. But it gets taken out because it reacts with the bag stuff itself. And therefore, it will keep it from spoiling a lot longer than it would. Just the opposite, by the way, is the old folk remedy for trying to speed up the ripening of something that you want to ripen quicker. What's the old way to do that? That also works. What is it? Well, no, I'm talking about to speed it up, to speed up the ripening. No? Well, I mean, this is not the one I'm thinking of. If you want to speed up the ripening of a fruit, let's say, you put it in a bag with bananas. Usually bananas work best. Because bananas, you know, are famous for ripening very quickly, right? Usually they ripen before you get around to eating them. They ripen so quickly because they produce a lot of ethylene. So if you lock the unripe fruit in a bag with bananas that are releasing a lot of ethylene, it's one organism releasing a chemical signal that will work on the other organism and speed up its ripening. By the way, before we leave ethylene, notice that it is actually the one, not abscisic acid, but ethylene, that's responsible for abscission. In fact, it's not just ethylene. It's a ratio of ethylene and auxin that has to be just right for the abscission to actually occur. All right, now let's look at some examples. In slide 5, the cartoon is an extreme close-up of the extracellular stuff just outside of the plasma membrane of a plant cell. And so we can see the cells, the entire cells in cartoon form. Oh, it's just one cell, before and after. But this cell is trying to undergo elongation. I mean, that's the, if you want to think about it as a goal, that's what's happening here. The cell needs to elongate. Now, to do that, it needs to grow in just one direction, not in all directions at once. Otherwise, it would just get it to be a big sphere, right? But think about how a plant cell is different from an animal cell. It, in addition to having the cell membrane, it has that very tough cell wall. So if a plant cell tried to expand, the cell wall would be an impediment, right? Therefore, to allow for cell expansion, that cell wall material needs to be loosened. And the cell wall material, which you see in the major picture, is made up of various kinds of protein fibers, represented by the brown things. I shouldn't say protein. They're not all proteins. There's chiefly carbohydrates, cellulose, and other things as well. But anyway, they're interlinked. They have chemical bonds between them. That's what makes it so tough stuff. So when the cell receives the signal, and in this case it's auxin, that it's time for loosening up the cell wall, what happens is that in response to that signal, proton pumps get activated, just like the ones we've already talked about, pumping protons out of the cell, right? Well, that's accumulating a high concentration of hydrogen ions or protons in the extracellular, in the cell wall space. And a high concentration of protons or hydrogen ions means that it's more acidic now, right? It lowers the pH. And that lowering of the pH changes the shape of these proteins that are out here that are acting as enzymes. But in this case, the lower pH actually activates the enzymes, and the job of those enzymes is to cut the chemical bonds holding these strands together. And that's how the cell wall becomes loosened. Now, that doesn't make the cell grow, but it allows for the ability of the cell to stretch now, because that cell wall material will slip past each other since it's loose. How is it that the cell is able to grow in one direction only? Well, these proton pumps get activated only in the side walls of the cell, not at the ends. So the ends remain tough. They therefore don't get wider because they withstand the pressure. They stretch longer in one direction because they've been loosened only in those sides. All right. Six. This is an example of the effect of gibberellins. Now, one thing that gibberellins do, I said it's a growth hormone, but one specific thing that it does is cause bolting in certain species. Bolting is very rapid growth of one part of the cell's body in response to some sort of environmental cue. So this is before bolting and after bolting. That happens because of gibberellin. Another famous use of them nowadays, which is not exactly a natural use, is that gibberellins that are used as exogenous signals. Exogenous and endogenous are opposite words. Exo means out, endo means in, right? And gen, like in Genesis, means creation. So, exogenous means created outside, endogenous means created inside. Our hormones, for instance, are examples of endogenous signals. We make our own. Drugs are examples of exogenous signals because we introduce them into our body from outside. Well, gibberellins are, of course, endogenous signals when they're occurring in the plant's body. But we now take advantage of the fact that we know what gibberellins do and use those gibberellins as drugs, basically, that we apply to, for instance, grapes. Grapes nowadays, you're used to them being around for so long that we kind of think they naturally grow the size they do. If you try to grow natural grapes without giving them any treatments, just wild grapes, they're going to be really small. like the ones that you see on the left. We treat them with gibberellins, though, to make them more marketable. And it's lucky that there are two separate effects of gibberellin. This works because there are two separate effects. If you go back to the table, which I'm not going to do, but if you read that table, it'll say that gibberellins stimulate elongation of stems. Well, remember what internodes are? Just the part of a stem that's between two branches, right? Two nodes. If you make an internode longer, that means you're moving two pieces apart more. That's one thing that gibberellins do, but it also another effect of gibberellins is to make the fruit grow bigger, in this case the grapes. Well, if it only made the grapes grow bigger, that wouldn't actually be such a big marketing advantage, because the grapes would be big, but they would be on the same kind of skeleton of stems, and they would all be crowded against each other, which would make it even more likely than they naturally are to have mold occur between them, because there wouldn't be enough airflow between them. But since it also causes internodes to get longer, as the grapes grow bigger, they also get more spaced out, and so they stay just the way we want them nowadays. But these really aren't natural grapes anymore. Another example of gibberellins, slide 7 shows. That's what the GA stands for here, by the way. So what we're looking at in different stages is a corn seed. Doesn't matter that it's corn, but it's a seed. And like any seed, it has an embryo in it, right? An embryo that can grow into an adult multicellular plant. Well, remember that there is endosperm within a seed, right? Endosperm is what's created from that second of the two fertilization events, right? The second sperm fertilizes that central cell to become the endosperm, which then becomes multicellular. That endosperm is a store of energy. So it is rich in potential fuel. But what endosperm is at the moment, mostly, is starch, which is the principal storage polysaccharide that plants use. What makes a polysaccharide a storage polysaccharide is that it's created for the sake of storing more efficiently monosaccharides that can be used as fuel. So the chief fuel is what in all cells? But what specific monosaccharide? Glucose. That's true for plants or any other organism. That's what we really burn as our fuel using glycolysis and cellular respiration. But if we have more than we need, we can save it for later by hooking those glucoses together to make a polysaccharide. Well, when plants do that, the result is starch. We animals do it slightly differently, but it's still all the glucoses that we're hooking together. And we make, instead of starch, glycogen. Major function of your skeletal muscles and your liver is to make that glycogen in response to incoming glucose that you don't need at the moment. And then, after it's been a while since you've eaten, your liver reverses that process, because your blood glucose level will start dropping when you don't have any more coming in through your intestines. And therefore, that glycogen that was made earlier by the liver will be broken down into individual glucoses that get put back into the blood to keep your brain alive. Well, the seed has starch, mostly. The endosperm is mostly starch, which isn't itself really fuel, but it can be broken down into fuel, glucoses, if needed. But like I said, the embryo that is alive in that seed is just barely alive, so it's using almost no fuel during its dormancy. When it gets a cue, though, saying that it is time for you to germinate, which depends on the species, in this case the cue is water, then gibberellins will be released. Specifically from... There are two layers of cells here, really. This outer layer which makes up the alurone, those are cells that are able to make proteins that act as the enzymes that are needed to break down the storage polysaccharide, starch, into glucose molecules. All right, but the alurone cells are not releasing these enzymes all the time. They're usually not. When they get the signal to release it, which is gibberellins released from the embryo itself, then they will start releasing their enzymes. But what causes the gibberellins to be released from the embryo is imbibition, or the intake of water. Imbibition means drinking. It's kind of like drinking from the seed's point of view. All right, so the water comes in. That causes release of gibberellins from the cells of the embryo. The gibberellins then diffuse away from the embryo through the endosperm and then finally reach the only cells in the seed that have the correct receptors to receive the gibberellin signals. And in response to doing that, those alurone cells release alpha amylase, which you can tell by the name is an enzyme, right? It ends in ASE. The amyl part of that means starch. Amylose is starch. So amylose is the substrate that amylase, the enzyme, operates on and breaks down. In the case of starch, what the product is after it's broken down is glucoses. And those glucoses then give the energy necessary for a spurt of growth in the dark. Photosynthesis isn't doing this, right? There's no light underground. This is what causes the root and shoot system to develop until it can start feeding itself once it gets sprouted big enough. So that's a gibberellin example also. Slide 8, here we have plants that live in very swampy areas, waterlogged soils, that in mangrove swamps, for instance, that have kind of an unusual, they're unusual compared to most plants because of their seeds not being kept in dormancy. So abscisic acid, the one that we said is misnamed for not really causing abscission, abscisic acid, or ABA, is responsible for seed dormancy. Remember that from when I was saying it in the table? Therefore, in most species, it's the presence of abscisic acid as a hormone that actually keeps the seed from germinating. But in these mangroves, the seeds actually don't produce much abscisic acid at all. The level of abscisic acid is very low. Well, if you have a low level of abscisic acid, that means you don't have the check in place keeping them from germinating, which means the seeds end up germinating very soon. And in fact, so soon that in the case of these seeds, they start germinating before they've even left the parent, as you can see here. So this is a root system growing out of a seed that is still on the parent plant. And it grows long, which is perfect for this species because this is basically a long spear now. And once it gets long enough, then the seed will actually drop off of the parent. And since these live in swamp, that spear will stick nicely in the mud, giving that seed exactly the right orientation for its root system to continue growing downward, and then a shoot system will grow upward. If it had normal levels of abscisic acid, it would just fall off as a seed and wouldn't fare as well in these conditions. Okay, now to 9. Here we have two examples involving ethylene. They're both mutants, by the way, or at least almost all of them are mutants in each of these two figures. There's one that isn't. Almost all of them are not mutants. There's a mutant in each of them. In the left one, though, you have a good example of an important thing that ethylene controls, which is the so-called triple response in plants. Triple response obviously is going to involve three things. If a growing part, like the growing part of a root, for instance, or it could be a shoot, but it's really easy to picture happening in a root. A root is growing through the soil, right? Which is a lot harder to grow through than the air. And it's also a lot more likely, since soil is not consistent at all, it's a heterogeneous mixture of things, it's a lot more likely in soil that that growing root is going to run into something that's a barrier. And so that is the external cue. If it runs into a rock, for instance, that's too big to just push away by growing, then the triple response will be invoked. And the things that happen that make it the triple response is that the previously rapidly elongating part will slow down in the elongation. And a second thing is that it will, instead of being slender when it was growing long, it grows wider. So it's growing, it's not getting long anymore, it's getting more stubby, which makes sense because that makes it more forceful if it's trying to push something out of the way. And then the third thing is that it will start curving as it grows rather than just growing in the direction that it was before. Which also makes sense because if it's running into something that it can't really get out of the way, the choice is that it's going to start growing around it instead, like going around a mountain. So those are the three things that categorize it as the triple response. Well, the triple response is invoked by ethylene as an endogenous signal normally. But here on the left, we have a bunch of normal, all but the tall one. All these short ones are normal seedlings, meaning they are not mutants. They have the normal genes. And they therefore are all responsive to ethylene. So if you just experiment, this is not normal air they're growing in. In the laboratory, they were given air with a lot of ethylene in it as an exogenous signal. And so basically all these short ones think that they're running into something because of the ethylene. And that, notice that they're not nearly as long, they're all wider, stubbier, and they're all curving. So that's the triple response being artificially caused by ethylene. The one that's not responding is the mutant. EIN here stands for ethylene insensitive. So because of a genetic mutation, it no longer is able to make the right kind of protein that the gene codes for that's necessary in this signaling pathway. So the ethylene is there, it just doesn't know it's there. Doesn't respond to a signal because the pathway is disrupted. So it just grows tall and slender, like a normal, like the rest of them would have if no ethylene was given to them. On the other one, we have kind of the opposite situation. The mutant in this case, which is the short one, all the longer ones are normal. This is called a CTR mutant, which stands for constitutive triple response. Have you seen this word constitutive before in any classes? Might have talked about it in the genetics part of 181, maybe not. The constitutive means a gene is always turned on. Now, there are certain genes that that's appropriate for, because some genes code for proteins that cells always need and that they just keep needing to make new ones. But the vast majority of genes are not constitutive. It wouldn't be appropriate for them to be turned on all the time. You want to control most genes, turn them on or off as is appropriate. Whenever you need the protein, you turn them on. Okay? And that includes the gene involved here that makes a protein that's necessary for this coding pathway, the signal pathway. All these normal ones are not mutants, and they therefore don't think they're running into anything because this is normal air. They don't have any ethylene that they're being subjected to. Well, this constitutive triple response mutant isn't actually being exposed to any ethylene either, but it thinks it is because the pathway has been turned on continuously rather than being correctly controlled involving ethylene. So it's shorter, wider, and curling. Slide 10 actually shows you a picture of what I was talking about before. This is leaf abscission that's occurring between a petiole, which, remember, that's the name of this part that you might be tempted to call the stem of the leaf is actually the petiole. The petiole is what is directly connected to the shoot or the branch. And that is where the abscission takes place. And it, obviously there's eventually a moment when it's completely free and it will fall. But that doesn't just pop off all at once. It's a gradual process because this is an injury that's taking place to this plant, right? It's opening up its tissue just like an incision would during surgery, and that's a site for possible infection. So it happens gradually so that scar tissue can grow and keep it from hopefully getting infected. But the reason it happens is because of a specific ratio of ethylene to auxin. So there's two different signals involved. And what happens is that the ethylene is produced more or less continuously in the body of the plant, and the auxin is produced by the leaf for its healthy part of its normal lifetime, but then starts to diminish once the leaf ages or senesces. And therefore, if you're keeping the ethylene concentration steady, but you're decreasing the auxin concentration, then the ethylene to auxin ratio will go up, right? It's the same number divided by a smaller and smaller number is going to give you a bigger quotient. You see what I'm saying? Anyway, once that ratio hits a critical level, then that's when it tells the plant it's time to lose this leaf. And the ratio gets more and more drastic, and the scar gets deeper and deeper until it finally falls off. Slide 11. In case you haven't recognized these, these are potatoes. And I'm sure you've seen something like you see on the left side, because we've all forgotten that we have potatoes in the pantry or some dark place in the house until we finally find them, and then they've started sprouting. And what they sprout, though, is not green. And it's also very stubby. This shoot system is really thick and fat, right, rather than long and slender. And that's because the plant thinks it's in the dark. Well, the plant is in the dark if it's in the pantry, but the plant, in a sense, thinks it's underground, which is where you naturally find tubers, right, which potatoes are examples of. So if it thinks it's in the soil, it makes sense for its root and shoot system that it's producing to be thick and stubby in order to have the power to move soil particles out of the way until it finally breaks the surface and is in the light. Well, if you just turn the light on, then the plant thinks it has broken the soil, even though it wasn't in soil at any of this time. And it will start growing long and slender parts that start greening up. By the way, you should never eat any green part of a potato, which is why you're supposed to keep them in the dark. That creates a poison that, I mean, it's not going to kill you with micrograms of it. But any part that's been exposed to light will turn green, and you shouldn't eat that part of the potato. The point here, though, is obviously this is an example of a response to a light. Specifically, it's an example of photomorphogenesis. Morph means shape or form. So, and photo means light. So, photomorphogenesis is a change in form in response to light. Now, this works in the natural situation because once the stubby in the dark shoot system breaks the surface, then it doesn't need to be stubby anymore. It's easy to grow through the air, right? So it gets long and it gets green in response to the light. Not surprisingly, this is another example of a plant responding to light. That's nothing new, but we've already talked about an example before when we were talking about the bending of the coleoptiles. What turns out to be true, though, is that there are two major categories of light receptors responsible for plants' ability to respond to light. And we can see in slide 12 one of these. In fact, this is exactly what's responsible for the bending of the coleoptiles that we looked at earlier. If you look at the graph, which is, notice, graphing phototropic effectiveness. Now, a tropic response or a tropism means a reaction to something. So a phototropism is a reaction to light. Tropisms can be positive or negative. A positive tropism means that whatever the stimulus is, there is growth or movement of the organism toward that signal or cue in the environment. And a negative tropism is growth away or movement away from that condition. In the case of phototropism, that's a positive tropism, right? Plants grow toward the light. They don't want to grow away from the light. But in the phototropic effectiveness here is graft versus wavelength, which we interpret different wavelengths as different colors, right? Well, not just by coincidence, because we use similar chemicals to sense light. Our eyes are sensitive to only a small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum that we call humanly visible light. That includes the whole spectrum, right? Roy G. Biv. Well, plants also respond to largely that same range, using different chemicals than our eyes do, but similar. Anyway, what we see here is that the phototropic effectiveness is much greater at the blue end, hardly at all once you get to green and red. So what we have here is one of the two categories of light receptors that plants use, the one responsible for the bending of the corn seedlings, and that is called. These are called, descriptively enough, blue light receptors. All right? In the second one, notice that corn seedlings, if they're placed along the edge of something that is white light is shown in. White is the combination of all colors, but when it hits a prism, the different wavelengths refract at different angles, and therefore each individual seedling just gets its own color of light. Well, the only ones that are bending are the ones receiving blue light, demonstrating that it's blue light receptors responsible for that particular response to light. I said, though, that there are two categories, and whereas you might think that the other category, which instead of being sensitive to blue light is sensitive to red light, you might think that those would be called red light receptors as opposed to blue light receptors, but they're not. They are called phytochromes, which literally means plant color. But anyway, that's the word we use for red light receptors. And a phytochrome's function is illustrated here in slide 13. If you take seeds, haven't germinated yet, and you keep them in the dark, that's the control, nothing happens. They don't germinate. If you then give them a blast of red light in otherwise total darkness, and then turn the red light off, they will start germinating. On the other hand, if you give them a blast of red light, and then you follow that with a blast of far red light, right at the edge of the visible spectrum, then they won't. It's like they've never gotten any light. It's like they're kept in the dark.
If you get, and you can keep going. If you give them red, then far red, then red again, they'll germinate, just like they got only one red and that's all. And if you give them red, then far red, then far red, nothing happens. So you can see that this is actually acting, this phytochrome is acting like a switch. Right? Just by analogy, if I come in and hit the light switch, the lights will go on and they'll stay on, right? Because I've switched that only once. If I come in and hit the light switch and then hit it again, and you come in, you can't tell that that light was ever on, right? You've switched it and then you switch it back off. So that's what the far red is doing. It's undoing what the red does, throwing the switch in the other direction. And molecularly speaking, we can see this happening in cartoon form in slide 14. So P here stands for phytochrome, which is a protein complex, part of which is light sensitive. But a phytochrome exists at any given moment in either of two different conformations or shapes, which are denoted as P sub R and P sub FR. P sub R is the name we give to the phytochrome. It's the same thing, just in different shapes. P sub R, though, is so named because it is the version of phytochrome that is sensitive to red light. If it receives red light, though, it's going to change it into the other shape, into P sub FR, which is then sensitive to far red light, which will turn it back into P sub R. Okay? So it literally is a switch. It's not just acting like a switch. It's a molecular switch in the form of two different shapes of the same protein. All right, so red light causes PR to become PFR. Far red light causes PFR to become PR. How can this be used effectively for plants figuring out important things? Well, these phytochromes are important for a good example of how these phytochromes work would be if you have a young tree growing in a forest among a bunch of older trees that are hogging all the light. If you think about it as a strategy, what would be the best thing for that young tree to do is to get tall as fast as possible, right? So it can have its own sunlight that it can hog. Well, the canopy of leaves by those older trees is filtering the light. Light coming in just as sunlight has all colors in it, including red and far red. But as it goes through the leaves of the older trees, it's losing a bunch of that red, meaning that it has more far red in it. All right? So you have millions of these phytochromes in a plant, and each one of them individually is either PR or PFR. But if you suddenly have light that is richer in far red than it is in red, then that's going to switch a lot of them into P sub R mode, right? And that will tell the plant we're receiving filtered light here. So that will bring in mechanisms in the plant telling it, grow tall now. And then if it gets tall enough so that it is suddenly in the open sunlight, then there's going to be much more red light that it's sensing, right? And so that population that was mostly P sub R is going to be switched into P sub FR. And that will tell the plant, now you've grown big enough, you have your own batch of sunlight to work with, time to concentrate on getting wider and thicker, secondary growth. So that's just one example of how these phytochromes can work. Does that make sense? Okay, let's go on then to 15 and look at a plant. This is the same exact plant, potted plant, taking it two different times a day, as you see, noon and 10 p.m.,
It's not wilting at 10 p.m. This is not wilting because of lack of water. It's a healthy plant. It's just in a different posture at a different time of day. And if you track it long enough, you'll notice that this plant will have this wider posture at noon every day and this narrow posture with the leaves down every day at the same time at 10 p.m. This is an example of a rhythm. All organisms, even bacteria, exhibit rhythms of some sort. And this one is specifically an example of a circadian rhythm. Have you heard of circadian rhythms? Well, circa means about, approximately, in other words. And die, as in the word diel, D-I-E-L, means daily. So circadian literally means approximately a day. Not exactly a day. Circadian rhythms are natural things that organisms have. We do as well, which is why, you know, you tend to suddenly get tired the same day, the same time every day, especially if you do the same things every day. You get into rhythms. But the reason it's called circadian, meaning only approximately daily, is that we have these natural innate clocks running in us that have a certain period, which is the time before they repeat again, that is not exactly 24 hours, just close. It could be 23 hours, could be 25 hours, somewhere around there. And the rhythms themselves end up actually being exactly 24 hours. So that means the clock, which doesn't really run at exactly 24 hours, needs to be reset or entrained each day for it to be truly 24 hour. Anyway, that's why they're called circadian, not exact-adian. Anyway, what is it that plants use to reset their clocks each day so that they run at a 24 hour? It's light. Okay. If you kept a plant, now you wouldn't want to do this for a long time because plants need light. But if you keep this plant in the picture in the dark for several days, then you'll notice that it starts to free run at its natural period, not 24 hour period, and its noon posture might be happening at 5 p.m. because it thinks it's noon. But each day, if it's in the light, it uses that light information to tell what time it is, and it resets its circadian clock. All right. Now, there are longer rhythms as well that are approximately a year. Those are called circannual rhythms, literally about a year. And circannual rhythms are important for a variety of reasons. We have circannual rhythms are what are responsible for in animals, for instance, for like heat. Certain animals come into heat at a reproductive time of the year, what we call heat. That's an example of a circannual rhythm working. Why did these evolve? Because you don't want to waste a bunch of energy on reproduction at a time when your offspring have very little chance of surviving. Right? You want to create your offspring at the right time of year, the correct season, for it to maximize the chance that they'll survive. That's just one example. But that applies to plants as well. Plants have seasonality, obviously, right? Especially in places that have drastic seasons, unlike here. So, once again, light, using these phytochromes, is responsible for entraining their circannual clocks. Not just their circadian clocks, but their circannual clocks. Now, if you think about it, it's not the only thing plants could use or other organisms could use to entrain their circannual rhythms. They could use the weather, right? Because summer is warm and winter is cold. But what's the problem with doing that? Or the potential problem? it's not reliable, right? There are certain winter days that are very spring-like, and certain really cold summer days when you have a fluke in the weather. So if the plants were using this as a weather, they might say in the middle of December, oh, it's time to sprout. It's time, spring has sprung. And it would start using energy, creating these structures that might end up killing the plant because they're not going to survive. So they don't use weather, which is unreliable. They use light, which is very reliable. And it's not so much the presence of light. It's when light gets turned on, dawn in other words, and when light goes off, dusk. So plants are measuring, using these phytochromes, they're measuring the time of the darkness and the time of the light part of the 24-hour cycle. And when they see that the light part of the duration of light is long enough, that tells them reliably that it's a certain date. Which is why plants can act, you can actually, almost to the exact date, if you really pay attention to trees in your yard, for instance, they will start blossoming at exactly the same date. There'll be different dates for different trees, but an individual tree, if you really keep track, will almost to the exact day start blossoming each year, because it's only that day that has that particular length of light. A really reliable cue. So it's phytochromes that do this. But slide 16 kind of demonstrates that there are two categories of plants doing this in different ways. On the top, the yellow one is an example of what we would call a short day plant, but really, it's not the day length that's mattering to this, whether or not they produce flowers. It's not the length of the day, it's the length of the night. So we call them short day plants, but it would really be more descriptive to call them long night plants. Because in these species, they will not produce flowers unless the night is at least a minimum length or longer. Okay, and they're measuring that with their phytochromes. Of course, we can play around with this now that we have figured this out, and florists do this. Nowadays, florists don't just have to wait until that plant naturally comes into a flowering season. We can cause it to happen artificially. What you see here, though, in a long night plant, which we can be called a short day plant, if the night, the gray part, is too short, below a minimum, then it won't flower. If it gets later in the year and the night is long enough, then it will flower. But if you really want it to flower when it's still short night, you just give it a blast of light in the middle of the night. And what it interprets that as is two short nights rather than one long night. And so it suddenly says, oh, we're in a totally different month. I better start, or in this case, not flower. Okay? That's just the opposite of the so-called long day plants that are better described as short night plants. They require a short night to flower, but otherwise operate the same way as far as their sensors are concerned. And you can fool them as well. If the night is long, they would normally not flower, but if you give them a flash of light in the middle of the night, they'll start to flower because they think it's two short nights. Obviously, that's light reception that's causing that, but as I said earlier, I already told you that it's specifically the phytochromes, not the blue light receptors that are doing this. It's the phytochromes, and we can see that on 17. So instead of using blasts of white light, which has all the colors in it, you can do this trick of red, then far red on these. If you give it just red, that will disturb it because it'll switch the switch one way. If you get red and far red, it's like nothing happened, right? So it thinks that's still a long night. Red, far red, and red, you've switched it on, off, and back on again, and so on. So that demonstrates that it specifically is phytochromes working, not blue light receptors. All right, so that's a phototropism. In slide 18, we have a different kind of tropism. This is gravitropism. Or a gravitropic response. Gravitropism, as the name implies, is response to gravity. Now, this is important for plants because they need to know which way is up, which way is down. And a very reliable indicator of that is gravity, right? Gravity is always in the down direction. No matter what position your own body is in, if you can detect where gravity is pulling, you know where down is. Important for a plant because a root system needs to grow downward. A shoot system needs to grow upward, right? It's not going to unless it knows where up and down are. So the question here is, how does the plant sense gravity? It's not really directly sensing gravity. But inside the cells of plants, which we see here in close-up, in this case it's part of a root, but inside the cells are specialized plastids. Like, plastids is kind of a general term. A chloroplast is an example of a plastid, but it's not the only kind of plastid. These ones are specialized plastids called statoliths that contain really dense granules of starch. By being really dense, that means they're packing a lot of matter into very little space, right? That's the definition of density. And so dense things, things that are denser than their surroundings, the rest of the cell, in other words, will fall with the greatest force due to gravity. And therefore, wherever these statoliths end up settling, whatever side of the cell they end up piling up, that tells the cell this is down. And so it depends on where the cell is. If it's in a root, then that's going to bring about a positive gravitropism, right? Roots have positive gravitropism because they grow downward toward the gravity. Shoot cells, though, have negative gravitropism. They sense this is down, but they grow in the opposite direction to get taller. And this is very similar, by the way, to what happens in us in our inner ears. Our ears are dual sense organs. They're obviously organs of audition or hearing, but they're also the organ of another special sense called balance. We need to know what up and down is so that we can contract the right muscles to keep us from falling over. And that's done by the inner ear, including the semicircular canals, which have tiny little rocks in them called otoliths. Odo means ear, lith means rock. So ear rocks, what it literally means, tiny little rock particles suspended in the liquid that fills these semicircular canals. And we have three on each ear, one in the X direction, one in the Y direction, one in the Z direction. When our head is tilted into a different direction, that swirls the liquid. But the otoliths are heavier than everything else, so they will settle to whatever the current down position is. And that will press on little nerve endings that send information to the brain, telling it to compute where down is, and therefore cause the right butt muscles in the body to contract so that you stay up. And you can easily confuse this, right? Kids do this all the time by spinning around intentionally to make themselves dizzy. Well, you're causing one ear to say, this is down, and the other ear says, this is down, and your brain gets confused, and not the correct muscles are triggered, and you fall over. You can't even help it. Plants do this similar thing, though, with these statoliths. Slide 19, yet another tropism called thigmatropism. Now, thigmo means touch. For instance, some animals are classified as thigmotherms, like lizards can be thigmothermic. That means they heat their bodies up by pressing their bodies against rocks that have been out in the sunlight for a long time, and therefore they get the heat conductively from them. But thigma means touch, and thigmotropism is response to being touched. Like in the example in slide 19, this is two plants that started out identical, same species, same age, same size, same living condition, same amount of water. The only difference is that one of them was stroked each day by a human at a certain time, and the other one was left alone. And that caused that much of a difference in growth. Another example, though, would be those mimosa plants, the sensitive plants. Have you ever seen these that with little leaflets that you touch them on one end and they'll fold up, and then the next ones will fold up? Pretty quick for a plant. You're not used to plants moving so quickly. Oh, I forgot I had a picture. Slide 20 is a picture of these. So you just touch it barely right here. This is all one leaf, by the way. These are leaflets. But you touch one pair of leaflets, and they will fold up like pages of a book. And then these will fold up, then these will fold up, all within a few seconds. That's a thigmotropic response, obviously. But the reason it's able to happen is very similar to our own electrical signals that we use in our body, which are action potentials. Action potentials are changes in voltage that occur in animal bodies. This is how neurons send signals and how muscles send signals. Action potentials in animals are really fast, which is why, you know, you step on a tack, the information is sent so quickly that you step off of that tack before it even does any harm to you. And in fact, before you even feel it, because it has to reach your brain before you feel it. But anyway, similar thing is happening in plants, meaning those voltage changes are caused by moving ions around. That's why they're voltages, because ions carry charge, and voltage is differences in concentration of electrical charge. It just happens much more slowly. So instead of it taking milliseconds for this plant to close up, it takes seconds. But it's kind of the same thing as our nervous system working. Okay, let's go through this table in 21, which, as you see, are environmental stresses, important environmental stresses that can do great harm to plants if prolonged or if bad enough. Drought, obviously a major environmental stress. We're familiar with that, living in a desert. Plants obviously cannot live indefinitely without water. So, if it's severe enough, obviously the plant is going to die. But desert-adapted species, like grow around here, have evolved various ways to deal with drought, at least up to a point. And one way that they can do this is by producing more abscisic acid, which... Remember, I said that that's in charge of whether the pumps work on the guard cells opening or closing the stomata. Well, if there's not enough water to go around, it's less important to open up your stomata so you can get CO2 for photosynthesis than it is to keep from dehydrating. And when the stomata are open, you're losing water. So you just shut down eating for a while, basically, by not allowing CO2 in, but at the same time, you conserve the water that you have. Flooding, just the opposite problem, obviously, too much water. The reason that's bad is because a healthy soil has soil particles and water both, but it has a lot of air pockets as well. So what we call the soil solution is the liquid part. We talked about that a little bit before. But there's plenty of air spaces in most good soils. If there's too much water, and you can see this easily if you overwater a houseplant, if it's flooded, then there aren't any air pockets down there. And therefore, there isn't nearly enough oxygen. Now, water does dissolve oxygen, which is how fish remain alive. But there's not nearly as much oxygen dissolved in water as there is in air. So if you can have air pockets in that soil, you can get a lot more oxygen to the roots that need it. Certain plants though, do well in waterlogged soils because they've evolved ways around it. They form what are basically snorkels, air tubes in their roots that extend all the way to the surface above the water and allow for gaseous air, including a lot of oxygen, to diffuse down just like a snorkel. Salt in too much abundance is very bad because of osmotic effects, right? The saltier the soil solution is, the more what the environment is in terms of tinnicity. If you have more salt, you're making the environment what? Hypotonic or hypertonic compared to the cell? Which one? Hypertonic, if it's salty. Because hypertonic means less watery, right? It's more salty, therefore less watery than the cell. Well, osmosis is always going to force water to move where it's less watery. So if you have a salty soil solution, the water is going to leave the plant cells and go to where it's less watery. That's going to dry out the plant, cause it to wilt. If it's bad enough, that will kill it. So plants, some species have evolved a way around this by producing solutes other than salt inside themselves, inside their own cells. Remember that in osmosis, it's only the water that matters. It's not the solutes. So you can have sugar solution on one side of the membrane, salt solution on the other side of the membrane. But if they're at equal concentrations, that means they're equally watery as well, right? And therefore, water doesn't move in one direction more than the other. So if water is tending to leave the plant cells, they respond by producing solutes, which reverses the gradient. If they produce these solutes so that it's that solute concentration inside them is greater than the salt concentration outside, that means they've reversed the water gradient, right? They've made themselves less watery than the soil, and therefore they'll continue to take water in. Heat, another one that we see around here. This is bad if it's too hot, simply because of what it does to the shapes of proteins. You should have learned in 181 that there are many factors that can change the shape of proteins, but two very important ones are temperature and pH, which is why any given protein has an optimum temperature and an optimum pH at which it has the optimum shape to do its job optimally. Enzymes don't work anymore if you change the pH, make it too high or too low based on its optimum. So that's a major danger of heat. Well, an evolutionary way around this is what are called heat shock proteins. Heat shock proteins are alternative versions of proteins that would be damaged by the heat that get made when it's hot and therefore take over the job of the other proteins that are damaged by that heat. These are different versions that work well in the new heat, in the higher heat, I should say, higher temperatures. And then cold, just the opposite problem. One reason this is bad is that if it's cold enough, ice will start forming. And when ice crystals start forming, they have sharp edges, which can puncture cells. And when you burst cells, that's obviously going to be tissue damage in the plant. But another problem is that when ice starts to freeze, become solid, and leaving just some of it liquid still, it's kind of like taking some liquid water out of the situation, right? Meaning that the osmotic balance gets thrown off again because the solid water doesn't count anymore. You have less liquid water, and therefore the osmotic balance is shifted. So they get around this by producing antifreeze proteins. Proteins that keep the water in them from freezing until it gets even colder, right? This is why we put salt on icy roads. That solute depresses the freezing point, meaning that you have to get it even colder before it will actually freeze, and therefore it thaws the ice into water. in plants, it keeps them from freezing to begin with. Another problem, by the way, with cold is that everything slows down, and it makes the membranes of the cells tighter, less fluid. Remember you learned about the fluid mosaic model of the membrane? Well, it can only operate healthily if it's the correct fluidity. It can be too loose when it gets too hot, or too stiff when it gets too cold. And plants can make adjustments to the phospholipids that are in the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the membrane. Remember that there are different kinds of fatty acids, right? Phospholipids have two fatty acid tails. But there are different kinds of fatty acids. There are saturated ones and unsaturated ones, right? You remember this? The unsaturated ones are the ones that have double bonds, and those cause kinks in the tails. So if you have only saturated fats in your membrane, it's going to be all straight fatty acids, and that's going to pack together tightly. You'd want to do that if it gets too loose in response to heat. But in response to cold, it would be too tight. It wouldn't be fluid enough. So you replace some of these phospholipids that are saturated with ones that are unsaturated, and those don't space together as well. It makes it more fluid. It makes it looser. Okay. 22, this is just a picture of these snorkel-like air tubes that we're showing you in the root system of certain species that live in waterlogged soils. No new information, though. Brings up 23, which is pretty interesting story, actually. The reason this is a slide in general is that it illustrates the notion of a signal transduction pathway. Signal transduction pathway is a sequence of events happening in any kind of organism, including us, where a signal causes something to happen, and whatever that change is now operates as a new signal for something else to happen. So it's a sequence of events, all right? But there's an original cue, the original signal, that causes the creation of a second signal and then a third and however many there are. That's signal transduction. This one's pretty complicated, though, and kind of amazing that it evolved this way. The plant has a leaf, as you see here, that's being injured by this caterpillar. Caterpillar is only worried about becoming a butterfly eventually, but while it's in the caterpillar stage, it's effectively an eating machine. It just spends its whole time eating. And obviously that's good for the caterpillar, but just as obviously that's bad for the plant, right? It's losing its leaf tissue. So something the plant wants to respond to this. Well, that's the original cue, the fact that it's being eaten. Actually, there's two original cues. Just the mechanical tearing of the leaf is one. That's being sensed. But also, caterpillar saliva is being introduced into the leaf cells, which is another signal. All right? In response to the wounding and into the chemicals in the saliva, both of which tell it, I'm not just losing my tissue, but specifically I'm being eaten by this kind of caterpillar. It responds with a signal transduction pathway, the leaf does, the plant does, that results in the cells of the leaf synthesizing or creating and then releasing volatile attractants. Volatile means easy to evaporate, like perfume is volatile. Right? That's why you smell it. If you just leave a bottle open on the other side of the room, it evaporates easily and makes its way over to you. These volatile attractants that the plant makes are attractive to a specific species of wasp. The wasp gets the volatile chemical, senses it, says, this is where I need to be. So it comes over to the plant, and this particular species of wasp that happens to be attracted to this chemical made by the plant happens to be a species that specializes in laying its eggs in exactly this species of caterpillar. So it comes to the caterpillar, injects its eggs into the body of the caterpillar, that then hatch into pupae that eat the caterpillar from inside out and eventually become wasps. Well, that's exactly what the plant wants to happen, right? Because it's going to get rid of the original problem, but in pretty roundabout way involving three different species. The final slide, 24, just another example of signal transduction in plants. Here we have one leaf of several that are suddenly a lot less healthy than the rest of them, right? You can see these yellowish spots. That's because there's been an infection. This one leaf has been invaded by a microscopic organism that can do it harm. And this pathogen, which is just a general word for something that can do harm to another organism, causes a couple things to happen. The spots that you see, which make it look bad in appearance, are actually something the leaf is doing intentionally. These brown spots die off. The signal that's sent in response to this, the detection of the pathogen, is that the plant's saying, okay, let's kill the cells all the way around where this pathogen has been detected. Because dead cells, the pathogen can't live on. It needs living cells. So it seals it off, kind of like what we do with forest fires, right? We dig around them so that it can't spread. So that's kind of a stopgap measure, saying, okay, let's keep it in place as much as possible so it doesn't get worse. But then that's the hypersensitive response, by the way. A whole other pathway gets invoked, though, to do another job, and that is to produce a signal, a hormone, in this leaf that's been infected that travels through the phloem of the leaf, just like hormones travel through our bloodstream, to the healthy leaves. And in response to that signal, the other cells are basically being told, okay, we have an invader in this part of our body. It's time for you guys to prepare for it because you might be next. Much like we respond to, you know, we respond with antibodies when we're invaded by something. The signal transduction pathway that gets invoked because of this hormone then leads to resistance by those cells, immunity, just like it does in us. Very similar mechanism. So even if the pathogen does make its way to these new leaves, it's much less likely to actually get a foothold in these immune leaves. Okay, that is the chapter.